Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we've got BYU's honor code and rape, the GOP and elections, a travel ban, and much more. And joining me this morning in studio, health, education, and environment editor Rachel Piper is here. Rachel, good morning.
Good morning.
Also with a senior political reporter, Robert Gerke. Robert, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Also, Tribune government reporter Christopher Smart is in the house. Chris, good morning.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. And editorial writer George Pyle is also with us. George, thanks for being here.
Good morning.
And you are welcome to join us with the stories on your mind. Put comments online at sltrib.com. You can tweet out to the hashtag TribTalk or call us. 801-355-TALK is that number. Rachel, let's start with a blockbuster of a story. Several rape survivors have come forward blasting Brigham Young University and the way that the school treats rape victims. And now, what are they alleging?
They're alleging that when they come forward to say that they've been assaulted, whether that's on campus by another student, off campus by a student, whatever, or off camp somewhere by someone who's not a BYU student, the honor code office gets a hold of this accusation and turns part of the investigation onto the student who reported it for breaking curfew or having a guy in their room or drinking or drugs, that kind of thing. Instead of focusing on the sexual assault allegations, could be argued more minor infractions are the ones that the honor code office focuses on because they're easier to get someone accountable for.
What is BYU's internal policy when it comes to sexual assault?
So they follow the federal federal Title IX guidelines, which is a rule sort of that makes universities be equitable to everyone, regardless of their sex. And so all assaults are required to be or should be reported to the Title IX officer who investigates the accusations, does sort of an internal school investigation. And then the office that is responsible for dispensing the resolution is the Honor Code Office. And so that's an internal policy of BYU's, is the Honor Code Office carries out the resolution to the case, and normally that would be against the alleged perpetrator.
Mm. As with many news organizations, the Tribune's policy is not to publish the names of rape victims, but the women that you and our colleagues Aaron Alberti and Jessica Miller interviewed gave permission to use their names. Why did they come forward with this story?
Well, a few of them, have just been so fed up that this has not been going anywhere, that they feel like they've been the ones who've been punished rather than offenders, and that they see that the campus is not doing anything to help rape victims and in fact doing the opposite. And so a couple of these women actually spoke out publicly last week at a forum held at BYU and sort of called out the Title IX officer who was there in the room and asked why they harm rape victims. And, one of them started a petition online to get BYU to change its policy to make victims immune from the honor code. And I think it's just sort of they're sick of it, and they're standing up, and they want their story to be told so that something can change and that future people won't be victimized.
In this forum, how did the Title IX officer respond? How has BYU generally responded to some of these charges?
Well, at the forum, and unfortunately no one from the Tribune was there, but we heard from multiple, there's basically no disagreement that the woman said, BYU has an honor code, and they do not apologize for that. And that even though she said that that it does chill reporting, they still have the honor code, and that's very important. And the official response from their spokeswoman has said, their ultimate goal is to protect victims and give them the support they need, and that the victims will never be referred to the honor code office for reporting, and that they will do more to help people understand the resources that they have at BYU.
Some really emotional stories in the paper this week. Can you maybe give us a sample of what one of the women who came forward has told you about her experience?
Aaron Alberti and Jessica Miller have done most of the reporting. I've just sort of been lucky enough to be in the room while it's all happening. But for the most part, you know, the stories sort of vary. But you know, there's a girl who she was on a date. She was on a blind date. She was told that they were going to be going to some innocuous activity. Sorry, like, you know, bowling or whatever. Instead, he drives her up to a mountain in Orem and rapes her. And when she reports, it's a very much, well, you know, we're going to have to talk to him. And if he tells us that you were having, you know, honor code violating sex with him, and we can't say that it was not consensual, then we're not going to go forward. And he was not a student, and they were also, according to her, investigating her for breaking the honor code based solely on what her alleged perpetrator would tell them about how far she was going with him. So, and that's, you know, obviously made it very difficult for her to go to classes and, you know, enjoy life at BYU because she's being, you know, harassed by the honor code office and dealing with the rape case and dealing with, you know, not really being believed about this traumatizing thing that happened to her.
Now, there's continuing coverage in this morning's Tribune showing how BYU's interference is affecting a rape case. And this is according to a Utah County prosecutor. What's the story?
Oh, so a woman reported a rape. And during, you know, she, as part of this case, she gave all this information to police. They had access to her story, to even her medical records from the rape kit testing that happened. And a Utah County sheriff's deputy, a friend of the alleged attacker, got this file, gave it to his friend, gave it to BYU, and turned it over to the honor code because he felt that she needed to be held accountable for what she was doing in this report because that was not up to the standards of BYU. So BYU launches an honor code investigation into the girl while her criminal case is going forward, and this is just making, you know, they're threatening to withhold her from enrolling in school, threatening to expel her, and this is making it very difficult for her to continue with the actual criminal prosecution that's happening because she's not a Utah resident. And so by getting kicked out of BYU, she's not going to be able to stay in the state, really. And so the prosecutor's office has, you know, like, begged BYU, please stop your honor code investigation so we can prosecute this, and they've said no.
George, this is a huge story. What's going to be the fallout?
Well, first, it demonstrates why it's important that we have an independent newspaper in Utah, in Salt Lake City. The other thing is, editorial board hasn't weighed in on this yet, but we will this weekend. This is just a disgrace. I mean, it's not like it's new. I mean, the female victims of sexual assault have been put on trial forever and questioned about whether they were leading somebody on or whether they were drinking or whether they were willing to have sex and then afterwards regretted it. And you know, they've been accused of this forever, so this is nothing new. But for an institution, you know, the stature of Brigham Young University to do this, to interfere with criminal cases that are ongoing, is just a disgrace. And I don't know how they're going to get a handle on this. Other universities, you know, have been accused of having, you know, kind of the opposite problem, where on they will expel or deal with alleged perpetrators on rather little evidence. A case of where, in both cases, demonstrates how violations of criminal law should be handled by the criminal justice system, which is set up to do this. And when universities weigh in, whether they're mean to the perpetrator or mean to the victim, they're not very good at this. And they shouldn't be. That's not their job. But for them to institutionalize, you know, the blaming of the victim, which is all you can call this, is just disgraceful. And maybe with this coverage and this petition and even, you know, static from the Utah County Prosecutor's Office, I mean, no flaming liberals they just want to do their job and prosecute this case. And if the victim is being harassed by BYU to the point that she can't stay there, that she can't stay in school. If she can't stay in school, then she can't stay in Utah. Then you've lost your victim, your witness, then you've lost your case.
The story has really touched a nerve, as you mentioned. Thousands signing an online petition. What do they want?
They want BYU to basically codify an exemption to people who come forward and report that a sexual assault has happened, saying, you know, you have immunity from the honor code, sort of similar to, you know, drug amnesty laws that people have, where if someone's overdosing, you can call police without getting charged for being in possession later. They want, if you come forward to BYU, you're not going to have a honor code investigation into whether you had a guy in your room or whether you were out past midnight.
We haven't heard how BYU is going to take that advice or that demand.
BYU responded to the petition by just saying that their first victim or their first Freudian slip there. Their first priority is victims, and they will continue to educate people on the campus resources that are available to them.
Okay, Salt Lake Tribune, of course, will continue to investigate this. Check up for updates on the website, sltrib.com. Let's move to another story that sadly has to do with rape. Rape kits. A new BYU study shows some telling data when it comes to processing rape kits throughout the state. What are the highlights of that research, Rachel?
It's by Julie Valentine, a BYU researcher who sort of came on the on center stage with this and sort of brought this to public consciousness back in early 2014, late 2013. With a study that said that very, very few submitted rape kits are ever tested, that they just languish on shelves, and that very few rape prosecutions happen. She came forward last week with a new batch, with another study that says, you know, despite all of this, there's still a low number of rape kits being tested. She looked at the new numbers and said, yeah, the numbers are still pretty low. And that's, you know, it sort of differs by department and by city, but you know, with some testing more kits than others, but it's still overall, it's not as big of a jump as you might expect after the, you know, a big influx of state dollars and that kind of thing in 2014.
And she's speaking out and pushing to say state law should absolutely require that all rape kits are tested. I mean,
yes.
What's her reasoning there?
Well, you know, she said that in the past she sort of was like, well, we should only test the ones that really, you know, need to be tested. But when you leave it up to the you know, decision of someone in a department, it's sort of like, well, do we really need to test this? No, because, you know, different reasons, then can we move forward and get justice for someone? She's saying it just should be blanket policy to do that, because that can catch repeat offenders, whether or not that's someone that the victim knew. Because that's one of the arguments that, well, if they knew their attacker, what's the point of doing a rape kit test, because they knew their attacker? But she's saying that can help if there's someone who is continually assaulting all of their acquaintances, then that will be shown up by these rape kit tests being actually you know, logged and tested.
So it's bigger than one person. George, I know the editorial page is in full of support of testing all rape kits. Why?
Well, as she says, I mean, there are so many. With lots of crimes, you have a high percentage of crimes committed by a small percentage of perpetrators. And the information that you can get from this, the DNA signature that you can get from these, can close a lot of cases, might even free some people who have been wrongly convicted by having this information. So it should be, in a perfect world, just routine that these get tested, the DNA gets logged in a database someplace. Even if it doesn't result in an immediate prosecution, even if it is a case where the attacker's already been identified in one case, and so it's not like you need to prove that there was an encounter, you've already established that there was an encounter, but you might be able to tie him to other cases, and that's important. I mean, this goes along with finding out that the parole board, you know, carries around suitcases of index cards and doesn't have all this computerized. You go to the movies and you watch, and the government has everything on a database, and we're worried about the Patriot Act and all the information the government has at the touch of a finger. Out in the real world, so often, maybe it's just in Utah, we don't seem to have any of this. The technology that's available isn't being used because we don't want to spend the money, because we're squeamish about rape, because we don't want to put money into the parole board because that just helps bad guys. They won't spend the money. And there's a lot of things that you could do to solve cases, to use big data, to track trends, in the case of the parole board, to make better guesses as to who is a safe bet to be released and who isn't. And they just, it's right there in front of them, and they just won't do it.
Mm. Rachel, we've reported over the past couple of years that the state crime lab is swamped. There's this you know, huge backlog. This new research shows it's not getting better. And that's even after lawmakers funneled some money to help support the crime lab. So where, how is the state crime lab positioned right now? Could they handle if there was a mandate that all rape kits are processed?
Well, some of that money went to identifying two private labs to sort of outsource the rape kit testing toward. And those, at least one of those private labs has just recently gotten an influx of rape kits, untested rape kits from Oregon. So it seems like they have the capacity to test a lot more than they are.
Robert, I'm curious if lawmakers are still talking about the lack of funding on the rape kit situation.
Yeah, I think it is an issue that they're aware of and that they've been working on over the last couple of years. As you mentioned, there was some money appropriated last year to get this project underway, and I think they sent in the first 300 or so, or got back just recently the first 300 or so that they sent in. And they're trying to chip away. I think this lab that they're using is out of Texas, if I remember right. And it takes some time, and they're trying to prioritize the ones that they think are, you know, the most pressing needs. But, you know, it is going to take some time. And it was sort of the way they monitored these, the way they tracked these kits, you know, was a little bit scattershot. You know, it's all sort of at the mercy of the local law enforcement and what they've got. You know, there's not a sort of a central repository. There's also, you know, like West Valley Police Department got a grant to process some of their rape kits. So they are, you know, they are kind of chipping away at this. The money, frankly, is almost less of an issue at this point than the logistics of it, because it does take some time to get through these. It does take some time to prioritize these and even just inventory so you know what you've got.
But do you think lawmakers would go along with a mandate?
Well, I think they kind of have gone along with the mandate to some degree, and that when they did appropriate this money, the money was appropriated to process all of the backlog. It wasn't just to process sort of a priority rape kits. Mm-hmm. It was to process the entire backlog. So in that regard, they have issued their own mandate that this backlog will be processed, you know? And so it's a matter of time. It's a matter of resources, I think, at this point.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in Salt Lake City, throughout the state of Utah, on Utah Public Radio. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, here in studio with Rachel Piper, Robert Gerke, Christopher Smart, and George Pyle, all of the Salt Lake Tribune. And again, if you want to join us, you can tweet to the hashtag TribTalk or put comments at sltrib.com. You can also call us. 801-355-TALK is that number. Let's turn to politics. And the Utah Republican Party says it will continue to reject signatures as a way for candidates to get on the ballot. Robert, what's their reasoning?
Well, the reasoning walking back just a little bit, they had disputed this signature gathering provision in the SB 54 that the legislature passed in 2014. So they had argued that because the state doesn't really have any grounds to tell the party how they can and or should select their candidates. And so since they are a private party, the First Amendment gives people the right to free association, and that they can't be compelled to adopt any mechanism for choosing their candidates, i.e., you know, signature gathering. They've said that they are going to recognize candidates who are selected through the convention, the caucus convention process, by delegates and not by signature gathering. So they challenged this in court. The Utah Supreme Court said, well, under the law, to be a qualified political party in the state of Utah, you have to let candidates choose whether they're going to gather signatures, whether they're going to go to the convention, or whether they're going to do both. And it is up to the candidate and not to the party. Now that they've got that definition or that interpretation from the Supreme Court, they're back in federal court now, saying, "Well, it's unconstitutional for the state to tell us that the members are that we have to let members choose which way they get on the ballot because we're the party. It's if they want to be Republicans on the ballot, they need to, you know, abide by the Republican rules, and the Republican rules say we don't allow signature gathering, and for the state to tell us that we have to allow signature gathering is an unconstitutional infringement on our rights to association." So that's the question that right now is pending in federal court. The party has said that it will or it plans to challenge the candidacy of anyone who only does signature gathering or doesn't get 40% in the convention that would allow them to go to the primary. Basically, at the convention, you have to get 40% of the delegate support to even go to a primary. So so they say they will challenge those candidates and expel them from the party and try to seek to have them disqualified from the ballot.
How are the candidates themselves interpreting all of this, processing?
Well, I think, you know, it's chaos right now, obviously, for all of these candidates who are sort of in this process. I think for the most part, they recognized that this has been going on for a while, since before they filed. These conflicts and disputes have been going on. And so I think they were prepared at least for some measure of chaos. But right now we're looking at tomorrow is the County Republican Party, County Republican Convention in Salt Lake and Utah County, the two largest. And then the following Saturday is the State Republican Convention. So we're now at a point where we are going to convention, and we don't know if the candidates who are coming out of that convention will be the nominees, whether they will be in a primary with somebody who's gathered signatures, whether those people who gathered signatures to get on the primary ballot and have been certified to be on the primary ballot by the lieutenant governor will actually be on the June primary or not, or if their candidacy will be challenged, whether they'll be expelled from the party and whether they'll be kicked off the ballot because the Republicans say, "No, you're not Republicans," and we get to say who is.
Wow.
So it's chaotic right now. And it doesn't show any signs, at least in the immediate future, of sort of being resolved. Right now, the judge was supposed to have a hearing today, actually, but he postponed it on this issue of the constitutionality of the state telling the party how, you know, who is and isn't a member and how they can select candidates. So he canceled that hearing today. Probably not a good sign for the party, frankly, that he seems to be of the opinion that he doesn't need to hear arguments on these issues, that he's got enough on the briefing. So, that's where it's going. And you know, we've got just a little bit of time because, frankly, with the state convention on the 23rd, they have to certify their candidates. They have to say these are the Republican candidates out of the convention on the following Monday, which they believe is the 25th. And then the county clerks have to send ballots to get printed by the end of the week for the June primary. And so we have deadlines now that are looming, and there needs to be some resolution and finality to this issue.
George, it's crunch time. The editorial board thinks that the GOP cannot act like a private club when it comes to voting rights.
Yeah,
explain.
I mean, just if you're going to have a party and have a convention and have barbecues and things, and if you want to initiate secret handshakes and stuff, that's your own business. And they have a constitutional right to association. The minute they want a spot on real estate that belongs to the state of Utah, which is the ballot, printed by county clerks in a system overseen by the lieutenant governor, it's our opinion as an editorial board and longstanding amateur constitutional lawyers that the Republican Party is wrong. The state of Utah runs the election. The state of Utah prints, distributes, and counts the ballots. The state of Utah gets to say how you get on the ballot. Now, they can't do discriminatory things where that could be traced to discriminating against a race, a gender, ethnic group, something like that. If they would do something like that, then the federal court would obviously step in and say, no, that's discriminatory. You can't do that. And, you know, with what's happened to the Voting Rights Act, that becomes maybe more difficult. But there's no question in our mind as an editorial board that the state has the right and the duty to define how you get on the state's ballot, which belongs to the state. The laws are set by the legislature. The law has been set by the legislature. It's being enforced by the lieutenant governor. And, you know, here's the real game of chicken. If you have the Republican Party coming up and saying, no, this guy here, he says he's a candidate. We're the Republican Party. We say, no, he isn't. Then you've got Lieutenant Governor Cox, Republican in good standing, who is going to be faced with the question of whether he has to obey the court's interpretation of the statute, which is pretty much, as far as I know, his interpretation of the statute, or the party's interpretation of the statute. And you could get to a situation where there is no certified Republican Party in the state of Utah. Now, you could still run as an unaffiliated candidate. I don't remember. Robert, you have to get signatures for
you
that?
You do have to get. So what George is getting at is sort of the argument that the Utah Democratic Party has made. And they made this argument to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court said, kind of rejected it. What they're saying is, well, to be a qualified political party, you have to meet A, B, and C, which includes letting candidates gather signatures to get on the ballot. And that's in the statute. And the Republican Party sent a letter to the lieutenant governor saying, yes, we're going to abide by the state law. And now they're not. And the Democrats say now they're not abiding by the state law. They don't get to be a qualified political party anymore. And all of their candidates who have filed to go to the convention and are not gathering signatures should be kicked off the ballot. And the party should be basically dissolved as a political party in the state of Utah because they're not abiding by the requirements of the law. Now, the state Supreme Court said, well, because they haven't kicked anybody off the ballot yet, we can't rule on whether or not they're violating the state law because they've said they're going to, and up to this point they still have, even though they've said that they're not going to at a later date. But until they actually violate state law, the state Supreme Court can't wade in. But George is right. I mean, the situation the lieutenant governor is facing is, well, they're going to contest this. The lieutenant governor has said, we plan to certify for the ballot anybody who gathers the signatures. That's the guidance so far from the court, and that's their opinion from their own attorneys. But, you know, this will obviously put them in a difficult situation where they could have the Republican Party challenging Republican candidates and the Republican lieutenant governor, who, by the way, his boss has gathered signatures, mm-hmm. And is going to convention, where they'll have to make rulings on these sorts of things. And they've also said, though, that they don't plan to kick Republicans who just go to convention off the ballot. They don't see themselves decertifying the Republican Party. They've rejected the Democrats' petition to have these candidates excluded from the ballot on the basis that they're saying that the Republican Party is not abiding by the rules and by the law. So it is, you know, it is a sort of a chaotic situation, as I said, and it doesn't show any signs of sort of letting up in the coming weeks. In fact, as I mentioned, with these deadlines looming, it's going to probably get a little bit more chaotic rather than less. And as George mentioned, and you can elaborate on the Tribune's the editorial board's position, the party now has expended months and months of resources trying to keep its control of its own membership, I guess. And the argument that you made is the argument they used is to sort of shoehorn the law in the first place, is that because the state runs the primary elections, taxpayers pay $3 million to run these primary elections the state gets to control who's on the ballot.
Yeah, I mean, the state pays for the primary election and the state pays for the general election. And that's where the really valuable real estate is. You come to the November election, you put names on the ballots that are created and managed by the state, by the counties. The state obviously has every right to do this. Now, this goes back to a couple of years ago, the Count My Vote campaign. There was a petition drive led by Republicans, mostly, former Governor Leavitt and others, who said that, you know, we're getting a little tired of this convention caucus system. Mm-hmm. It restricts too few people are involved. It pushes the party to the true believers, to the most extreme. And you get legislators and members of Congress who are way more conservative even than the mainstream Utah, which would be thought of as fairly conservative by most standards, but even beyond that. So they were saying, you know, what we need to do is we need to open up the process and make it more representative of Utah as a whole, the Utah people who identify as Republicans as a whole, to open up the process. And the party has just, even though the legislature approved it, the party has just fought this tooth and nail every step of the way, saying, no, we get to decide what we're doing. And it's as close as Utah comes to the voter suppression efforts that the Republicans mostly have been engaged in, mostly in the Old South, where they've gotten the Supreme Court to basically set aside the Voting Rights Act and do everything they can to make sure that the pool of voters is smaller and smaller and smaller.
The Republican Party chairman, James Evans, has said that if the federal court comes back and says it is constitutional for the state to tell a party how to elect its candidates, the question that is pending, and they will abide by the law because they're the party of the rule of law, or they could file an appeal to the Tenth Circuit, which, again, that promises the potential for months and months more of this stuff, and we could be through the election before we actually see resolution to some of these questions.
We could have primary and even in a general election, and all under the cloud of this, and come back later and say, well, you did it wrong.
Yeah.
And I don't know. You know,
you can't at that point really undo the election based on the, you know, they played by the rules that were in place at the time. And so, it's a thorny issue for the courts and for the LG's office.
We saw that, pardon me, this was an issue in the first debate between GOP candidates for governor this week.
Mm-hmm.
So how is it going to play out as the election moves forward?
Right. Jonathan Johnson, who's challenging Governor Herbert, mostly from the conservative wing of the party, has been critical of him for going this signature path. The governor has collected the 28,000 signatures he needs to get on the ballot, and he's been certified as a candidate by his lieutenant governor. But that's the way it works. I mean, I'm not suggesting there's nefarious stuff going on there. But Jonathan said, well, this signature gathering process diminishes the voice of rural Utah, because people don't go down to San Juan County or Kane County to gather signatures because people are so scattered and few and far between. They do it in the urban areas in Salt Lake and Utah County and Weber County and Davis County. And so Jonathan has said that, you know, he decided, despite the fact that he originally said he was going to gather signatures, he decided he was not going to gather signatures and challenged the governor to withdraw all of his signatures and just go to the convention route. If the governor, as he says over and over and over, is a product of the convention system and a supporter of the convention system, then Jonathan said, you know, challenge the governor to put his money where his mouth is and withdraw his signatures and just go to the convention system.
Another point in the debate this week, the overarching message was, from Johnson, is that Gary Herbert is not a real conservative. What did he point to?
Yeah, that seemed to be sort of the constant drumbeat, is that he's not conservative enough. Now, there have been a few tax increases during Governor Herbert's this last term. They raised property taxes for education. They raised gas taxes. And Jonathan Johnson said, in a time of surplus, the governor should not have been doing that. He challenged him on sort of a whole host of issues where he felt like the governor wasn't conservative enough. Common Core was one that came up. Jonathan has strong feelings that the state is giving up control of its public education system through the Common Core standards. The public lands lawsuit was one that got a lot of heat. Jonathan said that the state should immediately file this lawsuit to claim ownership of 30 plus million acres of federal land within the state's borders, and the governor has sort of dragged his feet on this and not taken the lead, even though the legislature has given him the tools, he's given him the funding, and the governor, you know, came back and said, well, we've got this public lands initiative that Rob Bishop has put forward, and this that would resolve federal land management issues for millions of acres in place. But the minute that we file that lawsuit challenging for asking or demanding, I guess, all 30 million acres back from the federal government, not back from the demanding that the federal government turn over the 30 plus million acres, the minute we file that lawsuit, the president's going to come in here and declare the Bears Ears National Monument, and we're basically going to buy ourselves a new national monument with that lawsuit, and all of the work that we've done on Rob Bishop's Public Lands Initiative is going to go down the drain. So that was sort of, I think, maybe the biggest highlight of that entire debate was their exchange on the public lands issue, and also on Medicaid expansion. Jonathan was critical of the governor for trying to pass Healthy Utah. And he said that, you know, Jonathan's criticism was that it's a budget buster and there's no caps and no, you know, and frankly, he said that we do enough in terms of providing care to the poor already.
George Pyle, is Gary Herbert a real conservative? Is Johnson's strategy of painting him as a flaming liberal going to work?
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, if you look at this race and you look at the national race, and people are arguing about even what it means to be a conservative anymore. I mean, most of us would think of Gary Herbert as being a pretty conservative fellow in the sense of, you know, not wanting to rock the boat and not wanting to go in there and file a lot of lawsuits. And I think he definitely has a very pragmatic point when he says, you know, if we file this lawsuit, you know, don't shoot Mongo, it only makes him mad. He's got a very good point that if the state would file the lawsuit, Barack Obama's response would be, okay, I got your national monument right here. And that would be the end of that. I mean, that's Gary Herbert's being very pragmatic, and he's going both convention and signatures. Rather than making an ideological stand, he's being very pragmatic. I want to be on the ballot. There's two ways. I'm going both ways. Jonathan Johnson is saying, well, no, that's not conservative. This is conservative. For example, Johnson was for the medical marijuana initiative that didn't get anywhere.
Right.
He's for basically the right to carry a gun any damn place you want. Whereas Governor Herbert is a little more now, let's talk about this a little bit before we do that. And you watch, you know, the argument between Donald Trump and Ted Cruz as they argue about who's really a conservative and what does conservative mean. Does it mean all kinds of limitations on what you can do because otherwise you would do libertarian immoral things? Or does it mean no limitations on what you can do, the more libertarian aspect of conservatism? And that's kind of the way that this is being pulled.
George raises the point about the gun issue, and that was one that the governor said, you know, we've got this system of concealed weapons permit background checks in place. It's worked okay so far. But Jonathan is pushing this constitutional carry where any adult without a felony record can carry a concealed weapon without a permit, so there's no background check. You know, and it's interesting that it comes down to the audience that they're trying to appeal to at this point. They're appealing to these convention goers, these delegates who are the more conservative or the most conservative of the party. And so they might see Gary Herbert as being a rhino or, you know, a soft on conservatism and selling out his principles. The governor made a point, and I think this is probably a valid point. You know, it's hard to actually quantify these things, but he said he's probably the most conservative governor of his lifetime, which goes back closing in on 70 years at this point. And he probably is. I mean, if you look at the John Huntsmans and the Olene Walkers and, you know, who have preceded him, and then you get back into the Democratic governors of Scott Matheson and Cal Rampton. And so it's hard to, you know, he probably is the most conservative governor of at least the last half century. But is he conservative enough? That's sort of, I guess, the referendum on the question when they go to the convention next week.
A lot of continuing coverage. Looking forward to those conventions. Let's switch to the other side of the political spectrum. Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski issued an edict this week about city-sponsored travel. And Christopher Smart, what did she say?
Well, she said there will be no travel to Mississippi or North Carolina. Of course, this comes in the backlash to legislation in those two states that is sort of discriminatory against the LGBT community. Charlotte, North Carolina, passed a non-discrimination law so that allowing transgender people to use the restroom in which they felt most comfortable. The North Carolina legislature went crazy and passed a bill that bans municipalities from passing anti-discrimination ordinances for LGBT. Meanwhile, down in Mississippi, the legislature passed a law that said that any private entity can deny service to LGBT folks based on religious preference. So if you are a cake maker and a gay couple wants a cake for their wedding, you can say no. And, you know, on down the line, it's really a license for discrimination across the board. Now, there's been a backlash. In North Carolina, PayPal, which was going to expand its base there by 400 jobs, it will not do that. Deutsche Bank, which had a plan to move to North Carolina, has called that off. Bruce Springsteen has canceled his concert there, as has Ringo Starr. So this is sort of just a wave of protest. Jackie, you know, is the first gay mayor in a major city in this country, and so she decided that that was a good idea. The city council went along unanimously. And as they did this, as they made this announcement, they said, hoping that the country would hear them, "Hey, you companies out there who are looking for a gay-friendly, LGBT-friendly city, come on down, because, you know, in 2009, Salt Lake City passed its anti-discrimination ordinance. And a year ago, I believe this is true, Robert, a year ago, the legislature passed a law that banned discrimination in housing and employment. And so Utah is actually ahead of North Carolina and Mississippi when it comes to civil rights.
Interestingly, the city council is also considering renaming a street after gay rights leader Harvey Milk. So I guess that's further evidence that Salt Lake City is an LGBT-friendly place.
Right. Well, for those who don't remember Harvey Milk, he was a gay activist in San Francisco in the 70s. And he was actually a New Yorker who moved to San Francisco in the early 70s. And because San Francisco was the early city to be gay friendly. And Harvey Milk opened a camera shop there in the Castro district. And it soon became a community meeting place, and he soon became a community leader. He ran unsuccessfully for the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, which is like our city council, a couple of times, but finally won in 1977. And when he got there, he was wrangling with another board member whose name was Dan White. And Dan White was a Vietnam vet, very straight-laced, didn't like, you know, all this gay stuff going on. At a certain point, Dan White resigned his seat and then wanted it back. Mayor George Moscone refused to give it back. And I think that Moscone and Harvey Milk had been thorns in the side of Dan White. And so one day, Dan White went to City Hall and he shot and killed the mayor, and he shot and killed Harvey Milk. That was in 1978. And so Harvey Milk sort of became the martyr of the gay movement. And so by naming a street after him in Salt Lake City, it's a ceremonial thing. But what it does is it says, you know, okay, we're gay friendly, but, you know, we already have a gay mayor, so, and two gay city councilmen. So,
and there's a public hearing this week on
there
the
will
rename.
Be a public hearing on this Tuesday, so folks can come and speak to this if they want to. But largely, I would be surprised if it didn't actually happen. And so there you have it. This has struck the nation kind of by surprise, is that Salt Lake City, which is seen by many to be a very conservative place, is this sort of liberal place for gays.
Talking about the week's top stories, and we need to take another break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW Salt Lake City, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Time for our final segment, the underplayed story of the week. Rachel Piper, do you want to kick us off?
So my story comes from Emma Penrod, posted yesterday and in today's paper. So it's about the Lake Powell Pipeline, which is a proposed project that is not close to being built, has a very vague price tag, somewhere in the $1 billion range. There's been some, you know, controversy over there not being really any kind of repayment plan for this. So she went to a state records committee hearing yesterday, which normally are not the most exciting events, but sort of was fun. We had a water activist alleging that there was no repayment plan because he basically grammed one after reading about it in the paper. They were claiming that there was one, but they couldn't tell anyone about it. And they rejected his records request, saying, "Oh, we don't have such a document, so you can't have it because it doesn't exist." So he went to the state records committee, who sort of did some sleuthing, found a YouTube video that showed someone displaying a PowerPoint presentation based on some numbers, and so their thing at the end of the day is like, "Yeah, this record probably does exist, and we probably should give it to people."
If you haven't seen that story, check it out, sltrib.com, and an issue we'll continue to cover. Robert, what's your pick?
I also, off Rachel's desk, Brian Maffley did a story earlier this week about a gravel pit proposal down in southern Utah that's creating a lot of furor. It's on state trust land is the goal that they want to build this. But it's getting some objections from local residents, and the interesting component of this is you know, this is land the state manages, and the state says it should be managing more of the land, and so then it raises the question of how is it going to manage the land, and it's sort of an example of that management. So check it out; it's a good story.
It is a good story, Christopher Smart.
Not to be outdone by Mayor Jackie Biskupski, Dean Perot, the proprietor of the Kachina Deli on 2nd Avenue, is banning all things Mississippi. You will find no magnolias at Kachina. You will find no sweet potatoes on the menu. That's gone. He will not be serving any American alligator, which is Mississippi State reptile. And he will be serving up no largemouth bass, the state fish, and last but not least, the state dance of clogging will not be allowed at the Kachina Deli on 2nd Avenue.
Very nice. George Pyle.
I knew I liked Kachina for a reason. I'm going to plug my own weekend column. The Center for American Progress has put together what they call the Anti-Parks Caucus of Congress. There's really no such thing, but they rated 20 members of Congress as the worst on public lands, public parks. Out of 20, 4 of them are from Utah.
George Pyle, Chris Smart, Robert Gerke, Rachel Piper of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks all for
Thank
your
you.
Time today.
Thank you.
We're going to wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. And this week, he once again opines on the differences between men and women.
This particular study was about the back end of our lives. Who's able to hold it together better, men or women? And it turns out that women still have us by quite a margin.
Do you want to read a little of this column?
Yeah, this is from 2007. Apparently, our brains start out rather evenly, although with some mental strains particular to gender. For example, men are generally much better when it comes to imagining ways to get hurt. Women are better at reminding them not to do it again. An article from LiveScience.com reports that men are said to be better at maintaining and manipulating mental images. I can vouch for this. I've had an image of Raquel Welch stuck in my head for years. I can retrieve it whenever I want. Conversely, women tend to be better at accessing info in their brain files. This helps them remember where stuff is. My wife remembers the location of every pair of socks I have ever left on the floor. The study tested the genders with problems such as recalling the location of objects in a line drawing and coming up with a list of objects, usually colored gray. Women supposedly did better in the last test. However, in the same time it took my wife to think up storm clouds, I came up with whale, Prozac, toolbox, corpse, gun, and grandpa's tongue.
Oh, my. Well, you've been with your wife for 40-plus years. So have you noticed the divergence in the way that you think as opposed to how she thinks?
Yeah. I shouldn't say this on the radio, but she's older than I am by 3 years. So she was already grown up, full adulthood, when she married me, and I was still largely a kid. So I recognized the differences right off. She was better with money. She was better with who should shut up when, that sort of thing. And now as we've gotten older and started to see little things announce their presence, like forgetfulness and that sort of thing. She's better at some things, and I'm better at other things. And fortunately, we'll stick together long enough to be able to help each other out.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Find all of the Kirby archives online at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW, UPR, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Jesse Ellis and Roger McDonough at KCPW, Friend Weller and Danny Hayes at UPR, and Emily Means from the Tribune. A program note, save the date, Thursday, April 28th at Trolley Square. The Tribune is throwing a Pulitzer Prize-winning book party celebrating Pulitzer Prize-winning fiction. More details on our Facebook page. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Tribune. Thanks for listening.